Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 180 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and let me introduce my co-hosts. First, we have Dan Webb from the Things in the Sky blog. Hi, Dan.
Hey, Max and everyone. Good to be with you as always.
Also with us is David Vanderhoof from the What Just Flew By blog.
Hello, folks. How's everything?
And of course, things wouldn't be complete without the one, the only, Mr. Rob Mark from the Jetwine blog. Hi, Rob.
Now, that's an interesting introduction, Mr. Max. I'll take that as a compliment, despite the fact that Dan didn't even say anything out of that. So, but listen, welcome to everybody. I'm glad we're back for another evening's fun.
Absolutely. And our guest this episode is aviation industry journalist and editor, Mary Kirby. Now, Mary is editor-in-chief of the airline Passenger Experience magazine and the Apex Media platform. Mary, welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, guys.
The airline Passenger Experience magazine part I get, but what does it mean, the Apex Media platform?
So Apex is an organization, the Airline Passenger Experience Association, and made up of many members of companies that are involved in the passenger experience. So everything from in-flight entertainment and connectivity, aircraft interiors, the mobile passenger, even Google is a new member. And of course, many, many airlines are members of the organization. It used to be known as the World Airline Entertainment Association, and they changed their name about 2 years ago. They have had various different media, but they really wanted to bump things up because, as you guys all know, there are so many really terrific and exciting things happening in the passenger experience space. So they realized that a really great, interesting, hard-hitting magazine would make sense, and also an online presence and a weekly digest and all of that and associated social media. So I'm in charge of spearheading the whole thing.
That's great. Now, until this is a new position, you were previously senior editor at Flight International. And of course, a lot of people know you as the Runway Girl from that blog. Now, does the Runway Girl stay behind as you move forward with Apex?
Well, Runway Girl, the blog certainly does. It was interesting because I know a lot of people had a hard time with that when I switched to a new kind of social media presence. I'm now known on Twitter as Apex Mary.
Right.
So it took a little while for people to kind of accept that because they were used to a little bit more of a kind of a fun, casual Runway Girl. But it's been grand. It's been fine. I'm still tweeting about the passenger experience, which is what I was doing at Flight International. It's just with a different employer. So I'm having a lot of fun. It's a lot of work, though, but a lot of fun.
All right. Well, coming up, we're going to talk about some of the aviation news from the past week. After that, we'll talk with Mary about the passenger experience. David has his This Week in Aviation segment. This is the second week of the new format. From the Australia desk, we're going to listen to Steve and Grant as they talk about several A380 news items and issues. Also, what some 150 Qantas pilots are up to. And also the tragic balloon crash in New Zealand. Also this week on Across the Pond, Peter Johnson talks to Lauren Richardson, a new aerobatic pilot, also author of The Aerobatic Project. And Lauren's going to explain what it's like to transition from a C-152 to a Pitts Special and what it was like in her first aerobatic competition. We've also got some more Grill the Geeks questions. That's our segment where listeners ask us tough questions and we see if we can come up with the answers. And we'll close out with just a little bit of listener mail. So why don't we get started with the aviation news? Our first article comes from Bloomberg. This is Boeing to shut plant with 2,160 workers as U.S. cuts defense. Now, Boeing has been in Wichita, Kansas since 1929, but starting in the third quarter of 2012, they plan to begin shutting down their operations there. The tanker work will instead be done in Washington State, and other work will be moved to Texas and Oklahoma. So this is a giant blow for Wichita.
Oh, man. Yeah, you know, it's not been a couple of good years down there in Wichita for anybody. I mean, Cessna laid off more than half of its people. Hawker Beach lost thousands. And now this item with Boeing. I think maybe everybody was kind of starting to think that when the engineers agreed to the deal with Boeing and the South Carolina plant on the 787, that maybe there was starting to be a little smooth transition somewhere there for the Boeing folks. And now, again, in Wichita, another 2,000 jobs. Oh, it's just going to be ugly down there.
David, wasn't Wichita counting on tanker work?
I believe so. But like everything else, I have a feeling that some of the tanker work probably will get routed to South Carolina where there's no unions.
Yeah, but you know, that makes me wonder, too. I mean, don't you think that some of the unions are going to start to say, hey, wait a minute, I think we had the wool pulled over our eyes here. You know, we kind of came to this agreement about the South Carolina plant, and now, by the way, you shut down Wichita and you send work to the South Carolina plant where cheaper workers are hiding out, because these are all union guys down there in Wichita. So,
right.
I guess the question that would follow is, and I know the answer. I think, Max, what did Boeing say that this work would go to Texas, Oklahoma, and Washington State? So are those union chops?
At least some of them are.
Well, probably the Washington one is.
The Washington one is. Yeah, the article says that. Well, actually, it quotes Mark Bass, who's the Boeing VP for MRO at Boeing Defense, Space, and Security, who said that about 800 jobs will go to Oklahoma City, Oak City, 300 to 400 to San Antonio in Texas, and 100 to the Seattle area. So, I mean, there's a net reduction, but it's not a total loss of all of the 2160 workers. But, you know, if you're one of those guys in Wichita, that may not mean much to you unless you're eager to relocate. So I guess, you know, in the end, the company has the right generally to, you know, position work where they need to or to remain competitive. I think this is driven by the desire to make sure that the Boeing MRO work that had been done in Wichita is competitive on a price basis. And to do that, looking at less defense work, looking at where the tanker is going to be built and so forth, it just appears to Boeing that they need to make these kind of changes. But it certainly doesn't help Wichita.
I just think the timing is interesting, I guess.
Yeah, and some kind of wonder how long they've, you know, been considering this or known that this was going to happen. But, you know, who knows? We'll probably never know.
Good point.
Yeah. So let's move on to our next story. This is from the Washington Post. Delta and Lufthansa among first airlines raising fares to cover new European emissions rules. This is about the EU ETS, the European Union. And I always have to think about this.
Emissions testing scheme, I think.
Emissions trading scheme.
Trading scheme, I'm sorry, yes.
So under this, the airlines flying in and out of the European Union now have to use carbon credits to offset their carbon dioxide emissions. And they get some free credits now, but they have to purchase any uncovered balance. And according to this article, Delta's added $6 per round trip to the ticket price for flights to Europe. Lufthansa says that they will raise prices, but not right away. So, I mean, this has been a kind of a growing issue, and we've talked about it in the past a little bit. We see that the Chinese carriers are now saying that they're not going to pay. Article also mentions that India is thinking about asking airlines to withhold emissions data. This could be brewing into a pretty significant international trade issue.
Yeah, there's been fighting about this for a while, and I know formerly the Air Transport Association, now Airlines for America, they've been mounting a legal challenge to this, but they recently lost that bid. But yeah, I'm not the biggest fan of the ETS scheme. I think the whole idea of of aviation reducing its environmental impact is perfectly valid. But I'm not sure if I really – well, here's my issue though. For number one, it's just one region. I think for an industry like aviation, and granted, it would be a monumental task, but we need a global solution, which plenty of other people have been saying that it's not just the EU that should be doing this. But in my opinion, really, I think do airlines really need this to reduce their emissions when I think that high oil prices are providing a very strong incentive for airlines to reduce their emissions already, since fuel is such a high percentage of costs and is competing quite often with labor as airlines' number one cost. So, you know, so I think airlines have a natural incentive to reduce their fuel burn, and then the environmental impact is a nice side benefit of that. And I think airlines' strong order books for aircraft like the 787, the 737 MAX, and the A320neo are complete evidence of that.
So you think that the market pressures of oil price are sufficient so that we don't need a regulatory approach, I guess.
Well, the other thing is you know, at this point, you know, this is just going to go – the airlines are just going to pass this along to consumers. And you know, is it really that great for the EU to be putting some upward pressure on ticket prices when the Eurozone is going through such economic difficulty? I just don't really see it. And I think I'm biased here just because, you know, I love the airline industry so much, but I think so much is going on with environmental impact, whether it comes to new engine development, new airframes, things like R&P, investment in biofuels. I think aviation over the past few decades has really come forward, and I'm not sure how this scheme is really going to help.
But, you know, a lot of this, too, I think, is certainly politically motivated. And you know, the first I heard about the European emissions trading scheme maybe 4 years ago, I think, that I first heard the first concept that it was even going to happen. And everybody even then said this was the EU's or part of the EU's plan to kind of show the world how much they had an influence over the region. And I think at the time everybody said, well, it'll never happen. But guess what? It did. And even for those airlines during that argument, as you said, that the Airlines for America lost, right up until that point, they said, well, you know what? We're just not going to pay it. And the Europeans have basically said, oh, yeah? Try us.
Yeah, and I guess my issue is because this is an EU effort. On some cases, you know, you have itineraries that aren't covered. So, you know, let's say, you know, I saw an example about this a couple years ago at a conference. It was, you know, let's say I'm flying from New York and I think it was to India or something like that. Well, if I go via the EU, yes, you know, my whole itinerary is covered by the ETS and I'll probably have to pay a higher fare. But then a carrier like Emirates, you know, I could transfer through Dubai and I'm still emitting a hell of a lot, except it doesn't touch the EU, so they don't have to pass that cost along to the consumer. So I just don't see it.
Well, I think another aspect of this that's made everybody, that's really riled countries around the world, is that if a flight departs Los Angeles headed for Paris, they have to pay the formula is based on the entire flight. And I think most people just kind of assumed that, all right, maybe the Europeans are going to do this, but that they would end up with a formula based on the amount of time they were moving through European airspace. And it just didn't happen that way. So it's not only that the Europeans have started this whole ruckus. And I'm not ignoring the aspect of, you know, what we dump into the atmosphere, but then it seems to be so incredibly unfair to airlines from outside of Europe that people they're incensed.
Well, the last thing that I'll say is I haven't really seen a definitive answer, and I've been looking, but I haven't found anything yet. But where is all the money going here? So I guess I'd be more content if what airlines are paying for this scheme, if it's going directly to help it researched technologies to help aviation reduce its environmental impact, that's one thing. And if that's the case, then great. You know, it's less bad. But if it's just, you know, going somewhere else, that really kind of annoys me.
That's a really good point. And I don't think anybody's seen anything from the Europeans that have said, well, if we instigate this, sorry, poor choice of words. If we institute this process, here's where we'll be in 5 years. And you'll be able to see the results. I don't think anybody's even talking measurement, at least not that I've seen.
Yeah, and that's a great point. And I guess we'll have to watch and see what happens here. I think we're, because it's upon us now, it's time that airlines have to, and governments or whoever, have to act because it's in effect. So I guess we'll be seeing a lot of this as this transpires. Okay, our next article, this actually comes from NPR, National Public Radio. New rules mean full disclosure for airlines. So the charge is that airlines advertise a low price for airfare, but don't include fees and taxes until later in the purchase process. And sometimes these can add up to a significant amount. So starting January 26th, we have this new DOT rule that goes into effect that says airlines have to disclose the total price in their advertised fares. Now, the airlines don't like this, and some charge that the new rule limits their right to free speech and represents government re-regulation. But I don't know. What do you guys think? Does this rule make sense? Is this really a good pro-consumer kind of a rule?
On one hand, I can see how it can certainly be annoying to see an advertisement from airlines saying, oh, hey, $9 fare, $39 fare, and then see an asterisk and something at the bottom in the fine print, you know, subject to taxes and fees. And really, the all-in price is a bit higher. But that said, I mean, you have to read the fine print on plenty of things other than an airline ticket. And I think the equivalent here is, you know, me going in a department store and yelling at the store saying, hey, all of your prices don't have sales tax in them. You know, I need to know the full price right now. And yeah, I mean, airline pricing can be annoying, and that's, you know, partially the government's fault for having a whole slew of different taxes that are involved. It's just, you know, I kind of get how it can be more clearer for consumers, and there are some parts of this rule that include some disclosures, have some more requirements on close disclosures on things like bag fees, and, you know, that I can understand. I think airlines, regulation or not, should be incredibly transparent, so it's easy to know how much I'm going to pay for a bag, what have you. But, you know, I mean, right now, you know, you see the advertised fare, you go to book, and then before you hit the big buy now button, you still see a breakdown of the fare and what the total price is. So, I don't how much or how much this regulation helps, especially considering all the effort that airlines are going through, because this, you know, this is a pretty significant change of the rules that have been around for years and years. So, you know, all these airline websites and reservation systems, what have you, are kind of built on this base fare, and then here are all the additional taxes and fees. Mm-hmm. As a consumer, I certainly understand the need for transparency, but, you know, I don't see why how it's bad that if an airline, what we already have with an airline website says, here's the base fare, here are the taxes and fees, here's your all-in price. As long as airlines break it out for me, I'm happy.
I can't believe I'm going to say this, but I agree with Dan.
You've been doing that a lot lately.
Yeah, I know. It's getting scary. I'm beginning to wonder, is he becoming more of a Democrat or am I becoming more of a Republican?
I'll say on some issues over the past couple of years, I've kind of gone more to the left, but nothing that would, I don't know.
Yeah, don't know. I'm sorry. On this one, I do agree with Dan. I mean, this is dumb. You know what? If they didn't tell you before you hit purchase, that would be a different story. But the fact that people want to see it all on one page and just pretend as if they've been scammed when they see it on the second page, I'm sorry. I think it's insane.
Mary, do you have any thoughts on this?
What, from the swinging liberal side of the equation? I'm actually a huge fan of transparency. So I would probably be somewhat opposite to the two of you guys. I actually think that transparency from the get-go is a positive thing. I just don't see how that can be negative for all involved ultimately. I have a good friend who recently flew Spirit Airlines with a couple of friends of hers. And she doesn't fly regularly. And, you know, she bought the super cheap Spirit fare and learned, of course, you know, when she got to the airport that it wasn't going to be anywhere near that inexpensive to fly. So I actually am a big fan of transparency, and I really don't see a problem with some of these new passenger rights legislation that's been passed. But I know that would be somewhat unpopular a stance with many of you guys, though.
I don't disagree with the transparency concept. I think that's absolutely true. And of course, now maybe we're mixing apples and oranges here, because, I mean, Mary, something you just mentioned about your friend buying a ticket on Spirit and thinking that everything was hunky-dory, and then getting to the airport and finding out there were all kinds of extras that she had to have. That's a whole different story. I completely
I know. What I'm trying to do is say, kind of just use it as kind of a parallel of the reality is that you and I and Dan and David, we're frequent flyers. We know this system. We understand how it all works. And these fees don't shock you or I. We know they're coming and we know exactly what to expect. We're used to it. But for people who don't, I try to put myself now, especially now that I'm writing about the passenger experience, I'm really trying to put myself into the mindset of what would I do if I am an infrequent traveler, or if this is, you know, something rare for me. Because, you know, I just think our experience, and this is also, by the way, with technology in general, you know, you have travelers out there, for example, that don't check in online before they go to the airport, and that don't, you know, are not tied to their mobile device and expect to be connected and have interactions through social media with their airline and all of this stuff. And I'm trying to put myself in their shoes. I guess that's why I think that being transparent and upfront about fees, there's nothing wrong with it.
Probably a good point.
Yeah, I tend to lean more towards Mary's direction, but my theory is this. Wouldn't the airlines love to see the transparency brought by the internet undone? Pre-internet business models were built on the assumption that consumer knowledge was imperfect.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's why God invented the marketing department. Now, the airlines, like many other industries...
Hey, watch what you say about the marketing departments.
But, you know, they've struggled. Companies have struggled to be profitable in a world where consumers have much more information at their fingertips.
Mm-hmm.
That coming through the internet. I mean, you can get on, you can compare prices, you know, bang, 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 make this choice. If you're very price sensitive, you've made your selection, off you go, you're done. But fees have brought profitability back to the airlines, and that's okay, I think. But price transparency kind of weakens the leverage they have now. I mean, don't you think? I mean, if the less transparent it is, the easier it is to differentiate yourself in the eyes of the consumers. And I think that's why airlines don't like this. They don't want to say it's easier to sell if you don't have to show your cards right at the start.
Well, I understand that. And I think, you know, airlines should absolutely be clear about what you're going to be charged for a bag and what have you. But the big, and that's fine. The big piece of this, though, is just more for the advertisement and the inclusion of government taxes and fees. You know, it would change if we're talking about Spirit here. You know, they might not be able to advertise the $9 fare anymore, but there's still plenty of other ancillary services that could be purchased at another time. So airline webpage, yeah, easy list of fees. But, you know, I'm not sure if does really including government taxes and fees in the advertisement price, does that really help much?
Hey, Dan, well, how about a carbon offset fee?
There we go.
No, there are some airlines that sell carbon credits on their website. Oh,
I know. But in light of, you know, what the Delta and Lufthansa, I think, well, the airlines, what if they just kind of say, okay, we're just going to tag on an extra fee. This is the carbon offset fee.
Yeah.
full disclosure.
I get bundling some things, and I think I don't travel as internationally as much as Mary, but I think I get how, you know, for the U.S. carriers, for the base fare, you know, has a lot more things in the sense. I think more of the international European carriers, you know, they'll have base fare and then slap on a massive fuel surcharge, and they'll break it out separately. So, you know, I can understand bundling some things, but, you know, I can understand if I'm an airline saying, you know, here's what I'm actually charging you, but here's what the government is making you pay for September 11 security and PFC and federal taxes and blah, blah, blah.
Well, I wish somebody would actually tell me what that September 11 security fee is.
It goes to the...
I mean, does that mean we only protect September 11th? I mean, where does that fee go?
It goes to the TSA, and the fee, I think, is slated to go up in a few years. Cranky Flyer had a good post on that recently.
All right. Well, why don't we move on? Let's talk about slots.
Woo!
Dan's all excited.
We're going to Vegas.
I think last time Mary was on, we were talking about slots at National and the special slots.
That's right. That's right. We were. It's crazy. That's exactly right. And then it finally happened. Right? They finally got the go ahead, Delta and US Airways, to do the swap.
And now we're seeing the results of that, I guess, and what the plans are. Delta's going to grow LaGuardia as a domestic hub. Is that right, Dan?
Yes, and I am sobbing a little bit still because in the process of the slot swap, my beloved Providence will be losing service to LaGuardia. But other than that, Delta for the past few years has been saying that they have a strategy to win New York. And the slot swap is a very big part of that, the big business travel airport for domestic flying out of New York. And Delta already has a significant presence at the airport. But once this takes place, I think Delta will have, and this is being phased in two phases, March and July. But once all is said and done, Delta will hold, I think, a little bit over 45% of the slots at LaGuardia. And they're really building up some key business markets out of LaGuardia. So Dallas would be the big one, and Miami, so big markets for American. So, some of the other big cities, Denver, Houston. So certainly a very interesting schedule. And I guess the big question for New York is what happens for American here, because American, their big network strategy over the past couple of years, they call it Cornerstone, and it's focusing on the cities of Los Angeles, Chicago, Miami, Dallas, and New York. And here you have Delta making a very big move in New York at the big business travel airport. So the question is, how will American win business travelers in New York when you have a smaller position at LaGuardia than Delta, you know, a decent JFK presence, but you know, Delta has a very strong JFK presence as well, and then United Continental's a huge hub over at Newark. So the question is, how will they continue to compete in New York? You know, they do have a an interline with JetBlue, but you know, I you know, one question, one possibility is, could that become a co-chair? But that's an issue that they have to work out with their pilots and their scope clause. And on American's negotiation website, they didn't mention JetBlue by name, but they did mention code sharing with a domestic airline at JFK. So I would assume JetBlue would be the biggest choice there. And then also doing a code share on a Northeast shuttle product. So that things are kind of tied up with pilots there as well. So great move for Delta, and you know, some big cities in some big major routes out of LaGuardia will be seeing some new competition. Some smaller cities will be seeing a little reduction in service, but I think this is, you know, a good move overall. And then the news that came out this past week was U.S. Airways announcing the first phase of their expansion at Washington National. Now, this isn't as dramatic as the Delta announcement, simply because Delta didn't really... Well, U.S. Airways is getting less slots at National than Delta is getting at LaGuardia. But at least in this first phase of announcements, U.S. Airways is focusing on some smaller markets, whereas Delta has, you know, these schedules to these pretty big cities, you know, smaller cities as well, but, you know, the Dallases and Miamis of the world, whereas U.S. Airways is adding, you know, Little Rock, Jacksonville, North Carolina, Pensacola, Tallahassee, you know, Fort Walton Beach, Florida, you know, smaller markets. But we'll have to see what happens because they've only announced the first phase. And because U.S. Airways did say that, said, quote, the final phase of the airline's plan to focus on its core service areas starts on July 11th and we'll add more routes from Washington, which will be announced in February. So I'll have to wait to see that because, you know, U.S. Airways, don't get me wrong, you know, they have a very comprehensive, you know, route network out of national, but, you know, still missing a couple bigger markets, in my opinion. So we'll see what happens with what they mean by core service areas, if they're boosting existing routes or, you know, we'll see what happens in a couple weeks. But it's thank God this is finally coming to an end because this started in August 2009.
And it sounds like then that both Delta and U.S. Airways are both, this is working out well for both of them.
Well, yeah, U.S. Airways has said in the past that LaGuardia hasn't been their strongest station, whereas, you know, Nashville has been really good. So even though they have their increased presence in Nashville is smaller than Delta's increased presence at LaGuardia, I think this will be really great for both airlines. And actually, it's funny you mentioned that because Delta was asked about sorry. I'll shut up in a second. Yeah. I'm going to an old blog post I have.
Yeah.
You know, what's interesting here is at an investor conference a while back, U.S. Airways was asked about, you know, why about New York. And their CFO said, the problem in New York is the fragmentation in New York. We weren't big enough. And later he said, as you look at it, if you're not number one in your market or a strong number two in your market, you're going to lose money in those markets. And, you know, right now, American isn't number one or number two in New York. You know, granted, you know, different philosophies, different people, but, you know, it'll be interesting to see. But yeah, very good for both airlines.
Again, we're speaking with Mary Kirby, who's now the Apex Editor-in-Chief of the Airline Passenger Experience magazine. Mary, I know Dan wants to ask you some specific questions, but before you do that, could you just kind of give us an overview of the current in-flight internet connectivity situation from the passenger's standpoint?
Okay, so in the industry, there's this kind of acceptance by most airlines that in-flight connectivity is going to be the cost of doing business. And so that's brand new. We've seen it probably in the last year or year and a half, where there's this kind of acceptance or resignation, depending upon who you talk to. But there's an understanding that passengers do want to be connected or have the option to be connected at every touch point in the travel experience, including the in-flight realm. And so we've got a number of now very, very big connectivity deals that have been thrashed out also in recent months. United Continental is one that really is going to set a standard because they've decided a connectivity plan for their entire long-haul fleet. But we're seeing the same from international carriers. And it's now just a matter of what are they going to bring on board their aircraft? What are the capabilities of the service? Is it a model that is going to be self-sustaining or is it going to be a cost point forever and ever, amen, for airlines? So those are the big questions right now, but connectivity is definitely coming. So expect to see it if you haven't yet. You know, in domestic U.S., passengers are increasingly accustomed to flying and having the ability to get it connected, but now you're going to start seeing it more and more on your international flights.
But of course, we're also, I just wanted to question your use of the phrase cost of doing business, because
right.
I'm not quite sure. Does that mean that you're talking about the need to install it, but not necessarily giving it to people for free?
That's right. There's there's a kind of an acceptance now that these systems need to be brought on board the aircraft. And they're not cheap. I think a lot of people are surprised when they realize just how much satellite-based connectivity costs. And it's not just the cost of the installation on wide-body aircraft, but it's also the cost of the service, you know, which is ongoing. And so you're seeing the big names come out with announcements, connectivity announcements, and we're going to see more and more of that. Every major airline is studying connectivity right now. Every major airline that has not announced a connectivity deal is studying it ardently right now. And we'll make an announcement. And US Airways is a perfect example. This carrier that's kind of really stayed on the fence, but even Doug Parker said recently, you know, we're just going to have to do it. So,
Mary, I guess one of the big things that happened recently is Gogo's IPO filing, and I was examining that, but I'm sure with your expertise, you found a lot more than I did. So what were the highlights there, and what does it say about usage and the sustainability of their business model?
Gogo, released this, as many companies do, they have interesting timing for these things. But of course, they released the paperwork for their IPO the day before Christmas Eve. Or no, was it Christmas Eve? No, it was the day before Christmas Eve. But it still was, kind of the Friday before Christmas. And a lot of people opined that perhaps some of the details in the filing explain the timing. Gogo was pretty candid, as it needs to be for an IPO, about the fact that its usage stats are not actually even where people had lowball predicted them. They're looking at about 4% take rate on the Gogo solution. But Gogo has reduced its losses, so it's stemming its losses. It's still a loss-making company. That is clear. But it has gradually increased revenue as more and more aircraft have gotten equipped. One of the things that really, I think, was interesting about the filing was what it revealed about the long-term agreements that Gogo has with most of the airlines. It has these kind of 10-year revenue share agreements. Will that bode well for them in the coming years? I'm not so sure. That's, those are very long agreements, and the life cycle on IFE, is about 5 years. So it will be very, very interesting to see how things play out. But you must surely be thinking to yourself, well, on one hand, you're saying everyone realizes they've got to get equipped. But then on the other hand, you have 4% take rates. Why would anybody, go along with that? That's got to be your question, right? What's the point?
I guess what I was wondering is, Gogo, I think the revenue for commercial aviation for the first 9 months of the year was, I think, well below, $100 million. I'm not sure if I'm remembering that right or not. But, compared to, something like bag fees, it doesn't really seem like Gogo or the airline partners that this is really a big source of ancillary revenue, and is that likely to change going forward?
I've got huge respect for Gogo. I think what they've done, they've managed to do something that nobody else has, and one of the reasons why in-flight connectivity is taking off all around the world is because of the work that Gogo has done here in the United States. I mean, it's kind of jaw-dropping when you think about what they have accomplished in getting connectivity systems on such a large portion of the U.S. fleet. I mean, it is stunning. But I think what's happened is that, number one, they are capacity constrained. They've done a lot of kind of testing of the model. They charge for their service, but they work out all of these arrangements, these free promos where they tie up with eBay or Google or whatnot. And they give the service away for free. And what it ends up doing is absolutely flooding the network. And so the people that are paying for this Gogo session, the people that have dropped $12.95, suddenly they get free and they're expecting the same service. And it's not, because the network is over capacity. So I think that Gogo has some work to do in terms of deciding what is the next step for them? Do they stay strong with a pay per session model, or do they do something else? And they've already, you know, they're already going down the path of becoming a multimedia platform instead of just a kind of pay per session provider. They're offering now streaming video and kind of a real walled garden. And what one of the reasons why they're doing that is because it takes the constraint off the bandwidth. If less and less people, you know, need unfettered access to the internet and really just are pulling the bits that they need, then it'll you know, let that system take a bit of a breath, and then maybe they'll be able to drive some revenue finally. That's the thinking. But GoGo is in a very interesting situation because it was recently named a distribution partner for Inmarsat's Ka-band satellite aeronautical service, which is going to start going live in 2013 when the first of three satellites are shot into orbit. And GoGo and another company called On Air, which is an Airbus-Sita joint venture, they both were named distribution partners. So if GoGo can kind of hold out until 2013, then it will be in a really nice position to be able to offer super fast speeds, satellite solution to airlines. It means that they'll be able to offer, you know, carrier, international carriers connectivity. It means that in-flight entertainment companies like Thales and Panasonic and others are going to need to talk to GoGo and On Air because they're the ones that are distributing the service. So GoGo needs to just hang on. And I think anyone who's really following the market will understand that there's more than meets the eye on that IPO. There's a lot going on, a lot of moving parts right now.
But you know, so, Mary, something that I've always wondered about is that every time I fly, and I don't know how often any of us all fly, but has anybody ever been on an airplane, an airliner, where they said, "And today, folks, for those of you that are interested, we are connected, and if you'd like to use our in-flight Wi-Fi, here's how you do it." I've never been on that, and every time I have found out about it, it's because I have to quiz one of the flight attendants by saying, "Hey, is this thing connected?" They go, "Yeah, wait, let me. Yeah, it is. I think it is. Lord. Yeah.
Well, I understand it, but sorry, Mary. How hard is it, Robert Mark, PhD, or whatever the hell you are? How hard is it to walk down the jetway and be like, "Oh, look, this one has a Wi-Fi sticker on it that everyone sees as I walk through the airport?"
Yeah, I know. But with my marketing hat on, if I were the GoGo people and I was trying to get more people to use my service, and I realized what, at least to me, looks like a kind of a mediocre job of my partners marketing my technology, I'd be a little upset. But I don't know. Mary, am I out to lunch on this, or am I just...
You're not completely out to lunch. No, so I have flown. I do fly quite regularly. I have had the opportunity to fly on GoGo equipped carriers. Delta does a good job, in my opinion, because its entire domestic mainline fleet, is equipped with GoGo, and of course, it does have the little signs also on the overhead bin. So you know you're on a GoGo equipped aircraft. Some of the other airlines have actually, you're right, they're not doing as good a job as they could with marketing the service, you know, they could step that up a notch. However, I really think that when this multimedia platform kind of comes into play with some of these other airlines, right now Delta has it, and American Airlines is offering the streaming video solution. But you know, what we need to see are these other airlines that have the full multimedia platform, and then I think then you're going to start seeing better marketing on behalf not only of GoGo but also the airlines. There's only so much a GoGo can do. I mean, it pushes the message online and does a great job there, but it's really down to the airline, as you say, Robert, that they could step it up a notch there with their marketing for sure.
Let's expand the conversation a little bit to include the aircraft interior in general.
Yeah.
And maybe you could talk about that a little bit, Mary, and particularly maybe in light of the fact that we're seeing, you know, huge numbers of orders for Airbus and Boeing these days. And what are we looking at in that regard for interiors, and where are they going?
Well, let me say from the positive standpoint, we have never lived in more exciting times than we do today for the world of aircraft interiors. It is phenomenal, the type of technology that is being brought on board aircraft, the type of materials that are being brought on board aircraft, the innovation, the industrial design. Cabins are going to start looking quite smart, and that includes economy class. So we're in a very exciting time. But as you rightly say, we are in a period of unprecedented demand, particularly for narrow-body aircraft. But we've also got, obviously, the Boeing trying to play catch-up on the 787 deliveries. You've got Airbus building the A350 now. And you have all of these orders, not just for current modern-day 73s and A320s, but also, obviously, the re-engine A320neo and the 737 MAX. And the order books are bulging. And what that is doing is putting a constraint on the supply chain. Now, I wrote about this for my former employer, Flight International, last year, where I highlighted, you know, some of the concerns that people didn't really want to talk about, but that were actually happening in the industry, where there was a bottleneck starting to be created in the interiors world. ILFC's, Udvar Hazy, I always pin him with ILFC, but he and his new leasing company highlighted the concerns back at an ISTAT conference last year, and it was... He was just so candid about the problems. And as soon as, you know, he announced that, look, we've got a real problem in sourcing seats and galleys in the aftermarket, then suddenly people started coming forward and admitting, yeah, this is actually a really big problem. And now it's getting worse. And we're starting to see deliveries impacted by the fact that some of the suppliers simply cannot keep up with demand.
Wow. Why do we keep having supply chain issues in this industry? haven't we learned our lesson?
Well, and this is what's kind of interesting is that, you know, what you've seen in other, you know, parts of the business, you may actually end up seeing in aircraft interiors. Will it get to the point where these airframers have to start buying some of their suppliers in order to save the day? It will be very, very interesting to see what happens in the next year or so. One of the things that, you know, airframers have been pushing a lot lately is a more, you know, they want standardization in the aircraft. In order to be able to meet the demand and meet these deliveries on time, they want to have more standard fits. But then you have to balance that with the fact that the airlines want to be able to differentiate their aircraft with, you know, what could be potentially disruptive technology. And so you have airlines that are banging on Boeing and Airbus's door saying, well, we want the newest Ku-band connectivity system, and we want, you know, the newest slimline seat with integrated smart monitors, and we want in-seat power, and we want, you know, this type of new environmentally friendly carpet and environmentally friendly foam and lightweight this and that. And then you have the airframer saying, okay, we've got to get to a point where we agree on a certain amount. And then that's it. And they're trying to rein in some of the desires in the marketplace in order to make sure that deliveries stay on track. But again, we're already starting to see some delivery delays, and it's because of the supply chain.
Now, Mary, on the standardization side, and I guess especially now that we have, you know, now that One World Sky Team and Star Alliance, they're all joint ventures across the Atlantic. Do you think there's any incentive there for the airlines to want to standardize, especially if they're thinking that it's almost, you know, it's almost viewed as one airline within three airlines across in a certain region?
Yeah, that's a great question, Dan. I mean, we're starting to see, I mean, Star Alliance kind of the standard bearer right now. They recently announced that they had chosen a baseline architecture for a seat for three Star members, including Lufthansa, where they've decided on a baseline architecture. But that's not, you know, they when I guess when we talk about baseline, we're just saying, okay, this is going to be the seat, but you get to pick your own colors. You get to, you know, if you want to do a fabric versus a leather or whatever, you can do that. But the whole point was they know that they have so many aircraft on order. They know that they need seats to fill these aircraft, and they want to lock in not only, you know, the knowledge that they've got a top-tier aircraft interior supplier providing them with the seat, but that top-tier aircraft interior supplier is able to do it on a grand scale for them and their partners. So, yeah, I mean, there's some airline partners that are agreeing to, kind of a baseline architecture. They haven't yet moved to joint procurement of seats. I think once you get to that point, you're going to have some very, very interesting conversations with these JVs if they have the buying power then to buy in bulk. But yeah, that's a very, very timely topic. But at the end of the day, they still want to be able to differentiate that seat. They still want to be able to put different IFE in that seat. But there is movement in that regard, Dan.
Yeah, I guess that's one thing I remember, because the example I was thinking, like, okay, well, now that BA and Iberia and American, okay, well, now we're like the same carrier across the Atlantic, guys. Maybe we should have something similar. And I'm especially thinking about America, because I think, does BA have all flat in business? I think they do.
Yeah.
Whereas AHA has the angle, whatever, you know, it's just something I think about, especially when American and BA, well, American has had like, oh, look, we have this shuttle between NYC and London Heathrow. Well, but you have all these different products.
Back when the alliances first started, and I can't believe I'm at a point where I remember when some of them were just forming. I was covering the industry at the time, which actually makes me feel really old. But that was one of the things, Dan, that they talked about in the very beginning was, you know, they were going to look at common IT architecture. They were going to look at ultimately joint procurement. They were going to look at consistent in-flight products. And that was always a big question that I would ask these alliances in the beginning. You know, why is your product so dramatically different, particularly on long haul is when it's the most stark. If you fly, a long haul carrier, if you fly a U.S. Airline and then you get to fly on a European partner, sometimes it's such a difference in service. And not to really call out people specifically, but I think a good example would be, and this is just from my own personal experience, kind of Lufthansa and its United partner. I've always found that the Lufthansa in-flight experience on long haul was just nicer. You know, you do wonder, when are you going to have a bit more of a consistency? I think we're going to get there. Like I said, not only do airlines realize that they have to bring connectivity to passengers, but they're also starting to realize that the passenger experience actually is important and people are making their voices heard about that. And I mean, this all goes back to the whole reason why I'm doing what I'm doing now, the whole reason why I'm involved with this magazine and working with Apex is because I have seen this shift where suddenly airlines are paying attention to the passenger experience. And a really great example is that American Airlines, when it filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection, the very next day, it announced what it is doing with its new 777-300ERs and how the passenger experience on those aircraft, including for economy, is so very important. And that they assured that through restructuring, they were still going to maintain a focus on improving the passenger experience. That, to me, was just, wow, such a moment. One day after.
Mm, yeah.
Mary, so not to bring it back to IFE, but I guess since we talked about connectivity so much, what's going on with embedded IFE over the next few years?
Yeah, it's amazing because you've got so many people out there that are predicting the demise of embedded IFE, and they have been doing that for so long. But I just don't see that right now, and here's why. Number one,
Mary, can you identify embedded IFE?
Yes. So embedded IFE is the seat back screens and the drop down screens that you would see on aircraft. And major embedded IFE manufacturers are Panasonic Avionics and Thales, but there's also a number of new players on the scene with embedded IFE and these, quote, seat-centric solutions where the content is stored in the actual seat. And they include IMS company. Lumexus has a fiber optics-based IFE solution. A lot of new companies in the IFE sector. And, and a lot of people saying, well, now that we've got connectivity, embedded IFE is headed out the door, and it's just simply not the case. Now, there will be airlines that opt to just offer connectivity, in economy class. But right now, virtually every long-haul aircraft, with just a few exceptions with these kind of long-haul, low-cost guys, virtually every long-haul aircraft is being delivered with in-flight entertainment. And there's an expectation there. And what's going to ensure, at least in the near term, that embedded IFE stays put is the fact that the connectivity is not akin to your at-home office speed. So people, and just as people who use GoGo find out, it's not the same yet. It's going to get better, but it's right now the technology is at a point where you're not going to be able to just scroll around the internet and entertain yourself because it just can't support that right now. So because for all of those reasons, embedded IFE is really going nowhere at this point. It's staying put. It's getting better. The screens are going to be skinnier. It's going to be a lot less weight. The content is getting better and better. But you know, you're seeing all these massive deals, and they are for connectivity and embedded IFE. A lot of them where these airlines are ordering both. They know they need to provide entertainment and connectivity. So it's exciting days.
Very good. Mary, tell folks where they can find more about APEX and the magazine and you online.
We're building up our online presence right now. And if they follow me at APEX Mary, they will be able to find out everything that we're doing.
On Twitter.
Yes, on Twitter. And it's really, you know, it's been fun because, like I said, it took people a while to kind of understand that I had kind of gone in a different direction than my long-term employer, Flight Global. But we are doing really, really exciting things over at this platform. And they can check it out at http://blog.apex.aero. And you can also see copies of the recent issues of the magazines. And the first issue that's coming out where I've been editor will be at the end of this month. And it's going to be gorgeous, guys. Wait till you see.
I can't wait.
It's going to be so nice.
And so we'll be able to see the issue online?
Yes, you will, in a digital edition. Yeah. And I think you're going to be pretty impressed. And in fact, we address some of the things that we talked about today in the magazine. So.
Great. Well, Mary, we're going to have you back again soon. We can't wait so long because you have so much great information and interesting things to say to us. So we'll have to get you on more often. But
Mr. Max, please, I have one last question.
Rob, what have you got?
Please.
Okay.
Mary, is there anything that, you know, we can do when we get on an airplane, whether it's a domestic flight or an international flight, that will help us get a better in-flight entertainment experience that we should know? Any tips, maybe like, by the way, always ask for this or look for that. Or I don't know. I just thought maybe there might be something.
Bring good earphones with you at all times. Nothing is worse than, you know, you sitting down and trying to enjoy a movie and getting kind of shoddy earphones. I wish that airlines improved their earphones, but it's always good to have a nice set of earphones. It really makes your entertainment experience so much nicer. So that's a must have in your bag.
How about noise canceling earphones? Do you recommend them?
Even better.
Yeah, I thought. Okay, Mary, thanks so much.
Thank you, guys. Take care.
Good night.
Bye, Mary.
And now here's David Vanderhoof, our resident aviation historian with This Week in Aviation.
Thanks, Max. Welcome to This Week in Aviation, Volume 4, Episode 2, January 8th through the 14th. January 8th, 1980, a Mooney M20K 231 lands in San Francisco. The Mooney makes the first transcontinental flight from New York in 8 hours and 4 minutes. The flight burns only 105 gallons of fuel. Unfortunately, I still have yet to find the November number and the pilot who made the record-breaking flight. January 8th, 1945, the J8M-1 Shushi flies for the first time in Japan. The autumn water, or the whoosh a samurai sword makes, is what Shushi means. The J8M-1 was actually a license-built ME-163 Comet. Interestingly enough, the aircraft was built using only the technical manual brought back to Germany by the diplomatic corps. The aircraft sample aboard U-5-5554 was sunk by the USS Bogue in the Atlantic. The plans and the prototype engines were aboard the Japanese submarine I-29, and that was sunk by the USS Sawfish in the Pacific. The flight was used was flown with ballast since the engines weren't complete. And before the end of the war, seven J-8M1s were built. Two still exist. One exists in Mitsubishi's home office. The other at the Planes of Fame Museum in Chino, California. January 10, 1934. The United States Navy sends its first mass formation to Hawaii. Six consolidated P-2Y flying boats left San Francisco. 24 hours later, arrived in Japan. The formation flew 2,400 miles or 3,862 kilometers, and at the time was a record for a formation flight up until World War II. January 12, 1916, Max Immelmann and Oswald Boelcke, both with 8 kills, are the first aviators awarded the highest Prussian Medal of Honor, Pour le Mérite, or For Merit in English. It is a Maltese cross that is enameled in Prussian blue. The common name for this award is the Blue Max. Aircraft of the week, the Cessna A-37 Dragonfly, otherwise known as the Super Tweet. You can't discuss the A-37 without talking briefly about its parent, the T-37 Tweet. Awarded in a contract in 1954, Cessna built a prototype which flew on October 12, 1954. The T-37 is a two side-by-side seat aircraft with initially two Continental J-69s. The J-69s were a licensed copy of the Turbomeca Malbor. One unique feature of the intakes on the T-37 was a FOD screen that would come up from the bottom of the engine to cover the intakes because they were so low to the ground. Also, the aircraft was given a 14-foot separation between the main landing gears for stability. The J-69 had a notorious ear-splitting whine, causing the aircraft to be known as the 6,000-pound dog whistle, or Tweety Bird, which eventually by the crews became shortened to just Tweet. In 1961, the U.S. Air Force wanted to add weapons delivery to the training syllabus. Cessna added a hardpoint capable of carrying 500 pounds in each wing. 65-gallon wingtip tanks were added, as well as the K-14C computing gun sight. With these changes, the T-37C was born. In 1962, the Special Operations Air Warfare Center in Elgin Air Force Base commissioned Cessna to build a counterinsurgency or COIN aircraft. The aircraft was to have better range, higher thrust, and short field capability. Cessna returned with the YAT-37D, which competed against the YAT-28E turboprop version of the T-28 Trojan. The YAT-37D was replaced the J-69s with General Electric J-85-25s, which doubled the amount of thrust. The wings were strengthened, and the 65-gallon tanks of the T-35C were replaced with 95-gallon tanks. The hardpoints were increased to three on each wing. A GAU-2B 20mm minigun was placed in the nose, and armor was increased throughout the airframe. Eventually, a fourth hardpoint was added to the wing. To test the aircraft, the United States Air Force decided it needed to send it to combat. 39 aircraft were ordered, and in the process, the Air Force changed the designation to the A-37A Dragonfly. To everyone else but the Pentagon, this became known as the Super Tweet. Operation Combat Dragon saw the first use of the A-37 in combat. 25 of the 39 were ordered were operated out of Ben Ho Air Base. The results were 3,000 sorties flown, two aircraft crashed on landings, 24 suffered from anti-aircraft fire, but not a single aircraft was lost to enemy fire. The lessons learned from Combat Dragon brought forth the A-37B, the definitive version of the aircraft. The gross rate was increased to 14,000 pounds from the original 6,500 in the T-37A. The ability to refuel was given to the aircraft. It was the last U.S. Air Force aircraft to require probe and drogue refueling. The A-37 had a max ceiling of 25,000 feet due to the fact that the cockpit was unpressurized. Eventually, 577 would be built. Of that amount, 264 were actually transferred to the Vietnam Air Force, eventually falling into communist hands after the fall of South Vietnam. After the war, an additional 110 aircraft were built for the military assistance program. Between 1980 and 1982, 122 A-37Bs were redesignated as OA-37Bs. AFRES and Air National Guard squadrons would use these aircraft. One of those squadrons would be the 111th TAS, or Tactical Support Group, of the Pennsylvania Air National Guard, which would be based at the Willow Grove Air Reserve Base. They were eventually replaced by A-10As. The T-37C and the A-37B were widely exported to Latin American countries. In 1995, both Ecuador and Peru used them against each other during the Cenepa War. North Korea used it for their Black Eagles demonstration team. The following nations have flown or are still flying the Super Tweet: Chile, Colombia, Dominican Republic, Ecuador, El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, Peru, South Korea, South Vietnam, Thailand, United States, Uruguay, and Vietnam. Currently, there are 10 on the civilian registers and 4 in Australia and New Zealand. The remaining 6 are here in the United States. Of one last note, the prototype YAT-37D was originally given to the United States Air Force Museum in Dayton in December 1964. It was yanked out of the museum in August 1966 to be the prototype of the YA-37A. After 2 years of flight testing, it was again returned to the museum in July 1970, where it still resides today. So, we'll run the randomizer for next week. And the winner is the Voigt O2U Corsair.
Oh, cool.
And that's the way it was, January 1st through the 7th. This is David M. Vanderhoof, the Airplane Geek Historian, signing out.
Wow, David, thank you.
Can I just add one very, very tiny point to what I thought was an astounding report about the Tweety Bird?
What's that, Rob?
In Vietnam, it was Ben Hoa, I believe, not Ben Ho Air Base.
Ah, but okay.
I just thought I'd pass that on.
That's fine.
Sorry.
So thanks, David. I know it's a huge amount of work for you to do. And do all that research and pull all that together. So we want to...
Yeah, it's cool stuff. It's cool stuff.
It's very fascinating.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australian News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast.
Dateline, 8th of January, 2012.
Struth, is it 2012 already, Grant? G'day, folks, yeah. And welcome back to the Australia Desk for episode 180 of the Airplane Geek Show. Boy, Grant, even though we were on last week's show live, this is the first Oz Desk of the year, and boy, it seems so long since we did the last one.
I know. It seems like ages since we did that one back before Christmas, but, you know, we had to come off the beach eventually and put on the aloe vera to get rid of the sunburn and everything, but, yeah, no, it's all good. Back in the office. Life goes on. 2012.
I'll tell you what, it's actually been a pretty quiet period for news down in this part of the world over the last few weeks, but one story that grabbed our interest surrounded Qantas A380s. There's been a few stories around about them. First off, Grant, A380 number 12 for Qantas has arrived, and it's been named the Phyllis Arnott.
That's right. She was the first lady in Australia to get a commercial pilot's license, and she's been her memory has been honoured with the naming on that 12th A380, so great to have it arriving. It's apparently going to get a bit of use pretty soon going up to Hong Kong. Qantas, as we reported last year, are going to be putting their A380s onto the Sydney-Hong Kong route. It's always good to see more A380s flying down here, and we're going to see more of them here in Melbourne as well, mate, because apparently Emirates are about to start flying their A380s to Melbourne. So we'll be getting Qantas, Singapore, and Emirates A380s flying into Melbourne. I've heard a lot of people talking about A380s being fugly and so on. But, you know, I think it's not a bad-looking aircraft. I've seen much worse still actually managing to fly. I've seen worse aircraft. I don't think it's that bad.
Yeah, I marvel at the engineering. I mean, even in these modern times, the engineering that goes into making such a complex machine and to get it up in the air like it does, and the same with really any commercial jet, but the A380 in particular just staggers me, the engineering. It's fantastic. I'll tell you what, some of the engineers that work on the A380 are going to have their work cut out for them, Grant. There's been a story going around this week about cracks, fatigue cracks, found in several A380s around the world, including one of the Qantas fleet.
Yes, it was first discovered on the first Qantas A380, the famous one that had the engine disintegration over Indonesia, and is still in Singapore being repaired over a year later. It's due to be flying again soon this year, but they found some cracks, some small cracks, I believe about up to 1 centimeter long, in the wing rib, wing skin join area. So I believe they were unexpected. They were a bit of a surprise. At first, it was thought they were associated with the damage, but then they found them on a few inspections of other A380s with Singapore Airlines, and I believe one or two Qantas ones may have been found. Now, some groups are trying to make out that the sky is falling, or at least the A380s will be. Others are saying, no, that's absolutely nothing. Who cares? We've been dealing with cracks and fatigue and metal structures for a very long time. My only concern about it is these aircraft aren't very long into their fatigue cycle, and the cracks are coming up. Was this a surprise? Were they unexpectedly discovered, which is what the indications are? And what's the implications for ongoing? Is it getting more stress than they expected and they discovered during flight tests.
Yeah, now, of course, you know, I don't pretend to be any sort of engineer, so I'm not going to comment too much on it. As you say, Grant, it does seem a little bit early into their life cycle for this sort of thing. But, of course, we pre-record this segment, and I'm sure that Max and the crew are covering this issue or have probably done so before this segment went to air. So we'll keep an eye on that one. We're hoping to get an engineer onto our show over the next few weeks that that might be able to talk about it, and hopefully you will be able to cut that down and put it in this segment. Grant, another story that's popped up here for Qantas talks about their pilots. Now, of course, their pilots have been in negotiations over job security primarily for quite a long time. We've reported extensively on that last year. This report here in Australian Aviation Magazine talks about many Qantas pilots leaving and heading over to the Gulf.
That's right. Well before all the industrial problems kicked in, it was reported that Qantas were allowing unpaid leave of absence to a number of their pilots that would allow them to go, and were actually even recommending that they go and fly with the Gulf-based carriers such as Emirates, Etihad, and Qatar. And we raised a few eyebrows. You know, what kind of airline lets their pilots go off and do this when, you know, what's this indicating? And of course, we're seeing the results where they're downsizing a lot of fleet requirements and international routes, moving them to Jetstar. So yeah, indications are that about 150 Qantas pilots have taken that unpaid leave and may never come back.
Yeah, reports that we've had from speaking to many people involved in that dispute over the last 12 months have told us that a lot of Qantas pilots, particularly international pilots, seem to get a lot of downtime. They're not getting a lot of flight hours, and you're taking a lot of unpaid leave and all this sort of thing. So, I mean, these guys have to go and find work to support their families, so you can't blame them for doing that. You know, and I guess really that's probably playing right into Qantas's hands. It's probably, sadly, from an employment standpoint, just exactly what their management wants to see happen. But Grant, there you mentioned about a lot of routes being shunted off to Jetstar. We note here from another article in Australian Aviation Magazine that Jetstar has announced it's going to add 28,000 extra seats onto its international holiday routes, including Honolulu, Bali, and Thailand.
Yeah, that's right, mate. And a lot of those routes are being flown by those A330s that were moved over to Jetstar from Qantas. Of course, when the A330s went from Qantas across to Jetstar, those Qantas pilots weren't able to continue flying them because they weren't through Jetstar. They weren't on those rates. And that's one of the reasons why there's been a lot of international pilots who aren't getting as much flying as they used to, thus more incentive to head off to those other carriers.
Now, moving across to New Zealand, and there's some very, very sad news that's come out of New Zealand over the last 24 hours as we record this concerning a hot air balloon that's crashed over there, apparently after hitting power lines. And sadly, there's been 11 people that have lost their lives here. This from Al Jazeera News.
The early morning joyride that ended in tragedy. 10 passengers and the pilot plummeted to their death after the hot air balloon's basket caught fire. It's believed it hit a power line.
The whole basket started to go up in flames. I could see two people, perhaps. I couldn't see anyone else. I was pretty shocked when I heard it was 11. But and then after that, I got to the corner and I saw it must have been released. Either it burnt through the line or the line got released off the basket. And it went straight up in the air and the flames just engulfed the whole balloon and then just it crashed to the ground.
It's unclear how the balloon came to hit the power line. Weather conditions were perfect. The pilot was one of the country's most experienced.
It appears that there were five couples on board, along with the pilot, and those couples are from the greater Wellington region.
Just horrible, tragic, and very, very sad news, Grant. And I know you're from New Zealand originally. I know you'd be familiar with that area, I'm sure, and just tragic news.
Definitely, mate. It's a real, real nasty crash, very tragic. We're all very saddened by it, and it is being investigated by the Kiwi authorities. So we're looking to see what comes out as part of the findings, and you know, naturally, balloonists all around the world are going to be looking to see if any of the learnings from this accident can be used to enhance our own safety. This is a tragic accident, and you know, we're all shocked at what's happened, and we're waiting to see what comes out.
Yeah, and I tell you what, Grant, gee, the poor old Kiwis—they've had a really tough time over the last 12 months with earthquakes. We know we've had some more earthquakes over the last couple of weeks there, and this news right on top of all of that. Boy, it's tough times over there. Our hearts go out to our friends over there across the Tasman in the Shaky Isles, and boy, we hope that things get better for them this year.
Yeah, mate, it's a bit of a sad way to wind up our first report for the year, but you know, onwards to the rest of the year, and let's see what it brings. Hopefully better news in the future.
Absolutely. We'll look for a more upbeat report next week. Until then, I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm still Grant McCarran, even in 2012.
Cheers, folks.
Yeah, that balloon accident was quite tragic. We actually had a few listeners that sent in emails asking if we were going to cover that. So we want to thank Steve and Grant for picking that up in their Australia Desk report. Now we have Peter Johnson across the pond. Peter's been working very hard to get some interesting guests for his segment, and I think he's come through with this one.
Clear prop.
Today, I'm joined by Lauren Richardson, and Lauren is speaking to us from Powys in Wales. Lauren, welcome to Across the Pond.
Hi there.
Thank you very much for joining us. Lauren, I've recently been watching your internet activity, and I'm really intrigued by the Aerobatic Project. What is it?
Yeah, the Aerobatic Project. It's really the love child of my foray into the world of aerobatic flying, I suppose. Basically, I started out at the very end of 2010 with my very first experience of aerobatic flying. And I was kind of hooked throughout 2011. I gradually started just flying more and more.
Yeah.
And started thinking about going to competition. Basically, towards the end of the year, I then went to my first couple of comps. And actually, I did quite well, really. As a result of this, it came to mind that actually this was something I'd really like to continue with and get involved with on a much sort of more involved level. And so I developed the Aerobatic Project as the website, as a means of talking about and displaying my competition flying and what it really is and what aerobatics is all about in Britain, in the UK. So the website is just full of photos and videos, and I do a lot of writing too, talking about aerobatics.
Yeah.
So really, the project is all about me just trying to share the love of it that I have.
Yeah, and reading some of the articles and seeing some of your tweets, you've had some interesting experiences recently.
Yeah, it's been quite an interesting year for me, really. It's certainly had its ups and downs, with the ups, of course, being much of the progress that I've made with my flying just lately. I actually fly a fairly decent aerobatic aeroplane nowadays. I fly Pitt Special.
Wow.
Which, for anyone that knows anything about the type, will know that it's a notoriously difficult aeroplane to learn to fly. And especially to learn to land. I'm quite a low hours pilot anyway, so yeah, going straight from Cessna 152s and PA-28s straight on to this high performance tail dragger was and has been quite an interesting learning curve. And a lot of the recent experiences I've been writing about have been about my feelings and around how I've gone about actually getting solo in this thing, and then of course going off by myself and flying aerobatic. It's not exactly a trivial thing, really, including going to competition as well. It's been terrifying at times. It's been utterly mind-numbingly terrifying. But yeah, it really is just the most fantastic thing.
What is your current flying status?
Okay, I'm a private pilot, and I've never really considered going into commercial flying. It's never really interested me. Although I have to admit that just the general kind of PPL style flying, just your cross country stuff, whilst being something that I do enjoy and is really good fun, it did leave me feeling that I wanted a little bit more, and hence the aerobatics.
And you've got some really challenging aspirations. Where do you see all of this going?
Well, basically, I want to see how far I can get with the competition flying. My real long-term goal would be to be competing on a world level.
Wow.
Whether or not I'll ever reach the heights of sort of the unlimited level of flying, I don't know. But we can only aim for that. I'd certainly like to be on the British team within a few years. That would be really cool. I'd also be really keen to get into display flying as well. It's just a different world that looks really fantastic to be involved with.
You entered one or two competitions this year. How did that go?
Yeah, I did. Technically, I actually won two.
Well, congratulations.
Technically as well. Yeah, okay. Yeah, the first one I entered, I did win. We turned up late due to weather conditions. It was a pretty bad day, actually, to start with. And I was just kind of thrown into it. Not knowing where I was or what was going on, just, oh yeah, go and fly, go and do your sequence, okay.
Wow.
So yeah, I just went into it, and actually I won out of a class of four, relatively convincingly, really, which
yeah.
It did, I will admit, come as a complete surprise to me. I really, really didn't expect that at all. Just thought I'd go along and have fun, you know, meet some people, just get to know a little bit about what it was all about. So yeah, walking away with the beginner's winner's medal was really quite something for me. The second competition, to be honest, I don't really count as well. I was the only competitor, so you can't really win if you're the only one competing, can you?
And so what happens in the quiet season? What do you do when you're not competing during the winter months?
That's a very good question. And actually, as it happens, the pits I fly is in for her annual over the next few weeks. So I won't be doing an awful lot of flying. Although maybe I'll just keep my hand in and do some general cross-country flying, take a PA-28 out for a couple of hours here and there, maybe visit some of the airfields I'll be competing at next year, get to know what they look like and where the competition boxes are going to be and what it's going to be like to be there and then go and compete. But for the most part, I'll be looking into how I'm going to structure my training, working out what kind of things I need to be practicing, which manoeuvres I need to be working on, drawing up plans for my methods of study and the kind of flying that I'm going to need to be doing. And cost are really important.
Yes.
I need to make things as efficient as I possibly can, because as you're probably all aware, aerobatics is not exactly a cheap hobby.
Sure.
In fact, it's incredibly expensive. And it's very hard to afford, very, very hard for me to afford. So there'll be an awful lot of preparation done for every flight individually, as to what I'm going to fly, what I'm going to work on, what I need to get out of it. And then, of course, the debrief is going to be really important as well. So that will be really well structured, including use of videos, in-flight videos, maybe some ground videos, and talking to people who will hopefully be critiquing me from the ground and giving me an idea of how I'm doing and what I need to be working on. So, yeah, that's what the winter will be. It's a lot of planning, really.
Now, on your website, there's a link. What's the Flight of the Bumbly?
The Flight of the Bumbly, yes, that's I suppose is the other half of my life. It's actually the first blog I started out with originally, which for a while has focused on my flying and my aerobatics, but originally and now actually the Flight of the Bumbly is my outdoor blog. As the other side of my life, I'm actually a mountaineer, rock and ice climber, fell runner, mountain biker, you name it, in the outdoors.
Putting us all to shame here, Lauren.
This is what a lot of people tend to call me, a bit of a thrill seeker. It's kind of, that's something I've been, that phrase is something I've been denying for years, but in all honesty, I can't really deny it anymore. When I spend all my time either jumping on bikes, dangling off ropes, flying upside down 180 miles an hour, or I'm out on the hill with a mountain rescue team. So a lot of what Flight of the Bumbly talks about is that side of my life, all the outdoor stuff, the rescue work, and just everything else that I care about.
Well, Lauren, this is a really, really exciting time, and we really wish you every success, particularly in your aerobatics. We want to keep an eye on how you're doing. Will you come back and tell us how you're getting on next year?
Yeah, I would love to.
Excellent. And where can the listeners find you online?
www.theaerobaticproject.com. Yeah, everything's on there, along with all my links.
And you're on Twitter?
Yep, I am groovy_nut on Twitter.
It's an exciting handle to follow. Lauren, thanks very much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks, Peter. That was great. Thanks.
You can find Peter Johnson at Nascot Hornet and at alphatangapapa.blogspot.com.
Boy, that was really cool.
I think Lauren is having a lot of fun flying.
Oh, my goodness. I mean, what a Twitter handle, groovy_not.
Once again, it's time for Grill the Geeks. This is our segment where listeners send us a question, and we see if we can answer it. This question is from David in Augusta, Georgia. During the Vietnam War, there was an incident where a MiG-17 pilot ejected right before he would have been shot down. An eavesdropping RC-121 heard the MiG pilot curse his GCI for telling him to intercept the wrong type of aircraft in a case of mistaken identity. What airplane did the North Vietnamese think it was, and what airplane was it that scared the MiG pilot into ejecting instead of engaging?
Oh, David, are you going to have fun with this one, baby?
It was an F-105 instead of that. What that he thought he was engaging. Instead, it was an F-4 Phantom.
Is that your final answer?
That's my final answer.
Okay, here's what David says. David in Augusta. He says, the aircraft, the MiG-17 pilot, was told by his GCI. What's a GCI?
Ground Control Intercept Coordinator.
Okay, sorry. So I'll start again. The aircraft, the MiG-17 pilot, was told by his GCI to intercept, was mistakenly identified as two F-4 Phantoms, but were actually two F-8 Crusaders. He says, there's a reason the F-8 was nicknamed the MiG Master.
Okay, he wins.
There you have it. Wow.
Just so everybody knows that most of the combat from the North Vietnamese Air Force was based on a Soviet system, and they were not able to think for themselves. They were all controlled by the ground. Hmm. They had radar operators who would tell them where to go and what to do and when to shoot. So strictly, you were not allowed to, if you were a North Vietnamese pilot, you were not allowed to think for yourself. Thus, when you were attacking two fully loaded F-4 Phantoms and were surprised by a pair of F-8s, that's why he would be cussing all the way to the ground.
Interesting. Now, that technique is that still used or has that been abandoned?
That technique fell when the Soviet Union collapsed.
All right. Well, thanks. So we'll be sending David some Airplane Geeks buttons. Okay, we need to move on to listener mail. We have time for just a few of them. We heard from Shaker. He says he heard of Kevin Garrison on the show, went out and purchased his CEO of the cockpit. Kevin Garrison was, of course, a previous guest. He purchased his CEO of the cockpit book that week and have finished most of it by now. He said he's also read the 747 story by its designer, Joe Sutter. After reading both these books, I had a couple of points derived from two recent aircraft incidents that you could debate on the show at some point. So maybe we can pick one of these, just sort of in the interest of time. One is concerning the Qantas A380, the uncontained failure last year. And the other was the Air France 447 accident. You guys have a choice between those two?
I'd say go with 447 because Rob's the expert there.
Okay, so we'll go with that one. Shaker says that in the first 50 pages of Kevin's book, he talks about and gives reasons why airlines do not train pilots for multiple system failures in the simulators. He says, I know that the accounts are fictionalized, but they can't be totally incorrect. Now a more fundamental question. I can understand that the pitot tubes could have gotten blocked by the ice and caused the speed readings to go out of whack and thus making the autopilot crazy. Now, whatever happens, you still have your artificial horizon indication, right? How would the pilots not know how their nose was pointed with respect to the horizon? Would they not know that their nose was too high and that they were in danger of stalling? So I think that's a great question, Rob. Can you sort of help us out with this?
Yeah, boy, I'll tell you something. That's a question that has been plaguing people for 6 months since that cockpit or since that cockpit data recorder came out. Nah. Because everyone has basically said almost exactly that. How could the nose of this aircraft have been so high? High enough, in fact, that the stall warning went off, oh, I don't know, 40 or 50 times before the aircraft hit the water, and still no one lowered the nose. And I don't know. I wish I had an answer for that. If we did, we'd really be further along. But I don't think anybody has a good answer for that one, at least not yet.
Okay, so it's still open. Do you think we ever will? Or,
well, you know, the final report from the DGAC, which is essentially the French version of FAA, is due out sometime, I believe, in June or July of this year. And I think that's what everybody's hoping, is that there is some clue somewhere in there about why this occurred. Why did all three of these pilots seem to be unaware of what the attitude indicator was telling them and ignoring basically the oral warnings that were saying, stall, stall, you know, and it's impossible to shut that thing off. And that's just
something we're all wondering about.
Okay. Thanks, Rob. We heard from Michael. He sent along a link to an article in the Marine Corps Times saying that this was the an article about the first UAV delivery of cargo in a war zone. That's kind of interesting. I mean, David, that sounds like something that would be a natural for UAVs to deliver deliver supplies or cargo or whatever in a hot zone instead of putting a pilot at risk.
Oh, absolutely. The program was done by the K-MAX, which is a Lockheed Cayman product. It's an unmanned helicopter. It made about 10 or 15 missions back and forth in all weather and at night, carrying sling loads. So it's a really great way to get supplies to our frontline fighters, in this case, the mountains of Afghanistan, without endangering another pilot. The worst will happen is you get the helicopter shot down and you lose the supplies, but you're still not losing a pilot, and you've got a way to keep the supplies flowing without the necessary pilot fatigue you have to worry about. You have a ground control unit back at home that or in the field that's running the supplies, and you can run them on shifts, but you're not getting fatiguing pilots because the strenuousness of a sling load helicopter and flying a sling load helicopter is really intense. So it's kind of this will be one of those UAV things that'll be extremely beneficial going forward. Maybe eventually we might even see it in the logging community that use sling loads for helicopters, a UAV hauling logs out of the northwestern part of the United States. So I think there is a lot of future in this kind of prototype.
Okay, good. We also heard from Owen Zupp. I think fans of Playing Crazy Down Under will be familiar with Owen, and he passed along a link to his new website, and I think it's worth giving him the plug because it's a great site, and that is www.owenzupp.com, which is OWENZUPP, or I guess he would say ZUPP. Is that right? Did they do that in Australia? Are we Zed in Australia?
Yes, like the blokes, they're Zed in Australia.
I think so.
How'd I do, Steve Fisher? Do I sound like a Australian? No, I guess not.
Okay. But it was a valiant attempt. Michael sent us a really complimentary email that I shared with the guys. Of course, we share all these emails, so everybody sees all of them. But he had some really nice things to say. Honestly, I'm kind of too modest to read what he said because it was very complimentary. But what he said is that, let's see, the part, though, that I wanted to relate was he commented on the Unplugged episode. That was our last episode, 179. Said he wouldn't mind seeing more of them, honestly. It was nice seeing everybody add their 2 cents into what aviation is in the coming years. Yeah, that was kind of an experiment. If you were to listen to one of these podcasts completely unedited normally, it might sound quite a bit different than what you hear in the final version. But it turned out that Rob and Dan and David actually behaved themselves really, really well for episode 179. And so the unplugged version, the unedited version, was not too different from a regular episode. So I guess I'll give you three guys hats off for that.
We'll, of course, take that that bow. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, guys.
Okay. All right. Well, I think that's got to do it for this episode. We'd like to thank our contributors, Grant McCarron and Steve Fisher from the Playing Crazy Down Under podcast. Find them at playingcrazydownunder.com. Also, thanks to Peter Johnson for his Across the Pond segment. You can find Peter at alphatangopapa.blogspot.com. All right, well, that's our contributors. Let's tell folks where they can find each of us online, and we'll start with Dan Webb. Dan, where can folks find you?
You can find me online at thingsinthesky.com, which is my blog, or you can tweet me at Dan Webbage.
And David Vanderhoof, where do folks find you?
You can find me on Twitter at DM Vanderhoof, on my blog at whatjustflewby.com, or you can find me on Google+. At David Vanderhoof.
Rob Mark, where do folks find you?
Well, they find us on jetwine.com. They find us on Jetwine at Twitter. On Facebook, there's Jetwine. There's something or other going on Google+.
although I'm going to need some more IT assistance from my comrades, Dan and David, to help me figure out exactly what it is I created and where, because I can't find it anymore. But I'm up there somewhere. Yeah, we're all over the place.
Okay. And I'm Max Flight. You can look for me on Google Plus and Twitter is Max Flight. Also at the 30,000 Feet Aviation Directory. You can find show notes at airplanegeeks.com. That'll contain links to all the sites we mentioned in the podcast, also listener comments, and even Airplane Geeks t-shirts. Also be sure to follow Airplane Geeks on Twitter and Facebook. And we're also on Stitcher.com, where you can stream this podcast right to your mobile phone. If you'd like to send us email, the address is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And we also have a listener line where you can leave us a brief audio message.
And if you want to call the Airplane Geeks, you can dial 361-GEEKS-01.
Thank you, Binet. Opening and closing music by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. So join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Good night,
thanks
everybody.
For listening.
Thanks for listening. Thanks.
You forgot one other thing.
And what did I forget, Dan?
Actually, later this episode, my first single is dropping.
What?
Your first single is dropping?
Yes.
Okay. Well, we'll look forward to that or not. Sorry, Mary.
Hi, it's Bob. Twitter.
Ooh,
you have
what
more
message
than
we leave?
140 characters, so leave me your name and phone number, and I'll call you back.
At the tone, please record your message. When you have finished recording, you may hang up or press 1 for more options.
And I will always love you. By the way, kudos, Max, on the sound effects. It's about time we started catching up to Vischer.
Actually, that was provided by Steve Vischer.
damn it.
It's been fun having you. You know, we should have a kind of an a cappella sign out sometimes, don't you think?
You think? It's tough to do over Skype, but...
probably. Okay.
But we could, you know, if we... You know what we could do? We could do... this is not a good idea. We could... if we did that, but each of us recorded ourselves locally... Then we could sync them up afterwards. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Or if it was not good, they would be, we could say we were stinking them up, right?
That's right.
Okay. Never mind. Just delete them. Okay. Good night, everybody.
You pain me.